Great. Administrator Regan, it's a real honor to have you here. We're all super pleased to be able to be in conversation with you, especially, you know, it's been 20 years since we've had an EPA administrator join us in the hallowed halls of an SEJ conference. So to get us started, you know, it's been a very busy year for the EPA, which means it's been a very busy year for all of us here. And I was hoping you could just reflect on what you feel some of the biggest successes have been for EPA, especially, you know, we've got a blitz of rulemaking coming up potentially in the next 6 months, and what else you have left on the table.
Yes. Well, thank you for that question, and thank you all for having me. I'm starting to question whether I am the unlucky one that has answered this call in 20 years. I forgot to do that research. Listen, I think that one of the reasons that I took this job, first and foremost, is because I love the environment, but I'm a father. And one of the interesting things about the interview with President Biden was his commitment to respond to, you know, the sense of urgency in terms of the climate crisis and ensuring that everyone in this country had clean air and clean water to drink. And so we've been very busy because he set the agenda from day one. Really proud of the fact that we have tackled HFCs, a really innovative regulation focused on methane as well. We just announced exciting rules addressing car pollution and truck pollution. Yesterday, for the first time in history, we at EPA created a national network to invest in clean energy at the tune of $20 billion. And so we've been exceptionally busy, and we're proud of that. And we, as you allude to, have a few more boxes to check over the next couple of weeks and months, and just excited to be able to tackle all of these complex issues with the support of a president who believes in the sense of urgency, not just for the climate crisis, but also the sense of urgency around the fact that there are still children in this country drinking lead poisoned water. There are still communities living on front lines, and we can't stop until we ensure that every single person in this country has access to clean air, clean water, and healthy lands.
And speaking of access, I would say press access, media access, and press relations is not always ideal in the revolving door of administrations when it comes to access to the EPA. And I want to know if you feel like EPA has done enough under this current administration to improve press relations, and not only that, but keep these relations strong into the future and into other administrations.
You know, I'm proud of our record there. I have to say that I didn't come into this job you know, really focused on how bad it was, per se. But I was smart enough to convene a meeting with my public affairs leadership to express my desire to do what I did in the state of North Carolina as a Secretary of Environment, which is be transparent and have a positive, healthy relationship with the press. I had no idea what the hell a fishbowl memo was. So when that was like the immediate answer, I wanted to know a little bit more. But I think we have sent that memo out and made it very clear to all of EPA staff that we want to be transparent. We want to have a very positive relationship with the press. Disinformation, misinformation is so prevalent. You all's job is so important in terms of how we get the facts out, so that people can understand exactly what we do and why we're doing it and what laws that we believe we have to do these actions with and what are the scientific underpinnings to help us to make these decisions. It's so important that we have a partner and an ally in the press to get the facts out there. At the end of the day, you know, this misinformation, disinformation campaign is an absolute threat to democracy, and I think that you all hold the keys to ensuring that we have this proper balance in the country. So, you know, we try to engage with the press as often and as frequently as we can. And, you know, just my general counsel took very seriously from day one the fact that we needed to retool our FOIA process. And one of the things that I'm most proud of is, you know, I assume the agency used to go back and forth through an appeals process on whether we should provide information or not. And when I look at some of the basic stats from 2019 to 2022, I think we've reduced that appeals process by 96%. I think it was something like 256 days. Now we're down to 13.6 days. It's stuff like that that, you know, I said to my team, I am not the experts, you all are, but this is what I want. I set the goals very high, and I'm very proud that they're meeting those goals. I believe I have about 20 to 25 staff attending today from our public affairs office, and we've been engaged from day one, and we'll continue to engage throughout this process.
And I actually want to pivot to a community that both we as the press serve and the EPA serves, and that's the environmental justice communities around the country. And I want to specifically talk about Louisiana and Cancer Alley. You know, environmental justice has been a cornerstone of the Biden administration's environmental messaging. And we recently had a decision come out of a Louisiana court, Louisiana v. EPA, that really hemmed our ability to apply Title VI in civil rights cases. And, you know, it was really kind of feels like a canary in a coal mine moment for other courts around the country and other similar, you know, civil rights situations around the country. And this also comes as the EPA concluded and closed an investigation into an environmental justice community in Cancer Alley, which I think a lot of people thought was going to be kind of a watershed moment for these kind of civil rights investigations. So I'm just wondering if, you know, given this legal context, do you feel that the EPA and the Biden administration's environmental justice actions, guidance, are keeping pace with this, like, changing and kind of scary legal context when it comes to how we can apply the law?
I believe so. You know, I'll say the Journey to Justice tour was so impactful to so many of us, and part of my strategy in creating this Journey to Justice tour was to introduce the world to some of the atrocities that I was aware of, but not completely aware of all of them. And so as we started this tour through Jackson, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, the name of the game was there are people in this country, especially those who sit on the opposite aisle of where I sit, that did not believe that there were any environmental injustices in this country. And so we invited the press in and influencers and everyone who would listen to take this journey with us to expose some of these terrible situations. And as a team, before we started this tour, we really evaluated all of the tools in our toolbox. And we knew that Title VI and some of the legal tools were some of the tools, but we also, I instructed my enforcement team to really look at all of the enforcement authority that we have. And we also, you know, took a look at all of the regulatory powers that we have. I'm excited to say that in the coming weeks, we're going to announce a really strong regulation addressing those chemical plants in Cancer Alley. We're going to continue to push our enforcement team to hold polluters accountable, and we'll continue to evaluate what tools we have in that Title VI space. You know, environmental justice didn't start yesterday, and we're not going to solve it overnight, but I'm very confident that in partnership with local community leaders and folks that are on the ground, we are remaining vigilant and as creative as possible in terms of using our statutory and legal authority to protect every person in this country.
Thank you so much. I have a million questions I could continue to ask you, but these fine folks are here at 8:30 in the morning and ready and willing to line up and ask you some questions of their own. And I think we have some folks in the audience that are going to help this process along a bit. It is my duty to remind everyone of SEJ's Q&A policy, which is SEJ and journalism group members are the ones asking questions today. They get priority, so there are people monitoring your badges and making sure that everything is copacetic in that regard. Identify yourself, state your name and affiliation when you're asking a question. That relates to rule number one. And no speeches. I shall cut you off. Please. This is a question and answer session, and there are a lot of people that want to have questions, and we have to respect the administrator's time. So please don't. and with that, I think the facilitators are going to get us started.
Thank you, Administrator Regan, for being here and answering questions. I want to ask about where the update is. Oh, my name is Chris Clayton. I'm an agriculture reporter from DTN, the Progressive Farmer in Iowa. And I want to ask about the update of the GREET model, really get into the weeds here of where you guys are at on that update and how do you see EPA implementing the GREET model update for the renewable fuel standard?
Thank you for that question. And, you know, I'll start by saying that from day one, Secretary Tom Vilsack and I decided to sit down and really look at the relationship between EPA and USDA and how we could heal some of those relationships and think about how we could use science to tackle some of the common issues that we have. And as we think about the GREET model, and some of the applications of the GREET model, Tom and I decided that there needed to be some updates to that model if we wanted to use that model for some of the future programs that USDA, EPA, Treasury, and others were designing. So USDA and EPA and some of the federal family decided to put some money into updating that model so that its application could be Clean Air Act compliant. We're going through that process. I feel good about that process because we have all the players at the table. And I think that the timeline that we originally announced has fallen by a couple of weeks, if not a month. But in the near future, the very near future, we'll have that model up and running and applied in the ways that we said it would be applied.
I'm Mark Schlefstein with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and I want to get back to the Louisiana lawsuit. In light of actions that you guys have taken as a result of the Louisiana challenge to disparate impact in that federal court case, including the dropping of civil rights investigations of the State Departments of Environmental Quality and Health, can you give some more specifics about exactly what the department is going to do with these regulation changes, and will disparate impact continue to be part of EPA strategies in Louisiana?
Listen, we'll absolutely keep every tool in the toolbox on the table. Disparate impact, civil rights, all of the lenses that we look at these issues through, we'll continue to do that. I don't want to necessarily tell the world all of our legal strategies in terms of how we plan to respond or what different tacks we plan to take, but we believe in those tools. But in the meanwhile, and it's not just on this issue, we face headwinds in the courts on a lot of our issues. And so part of our strategy is to be sure that we understand the current court culture that we're in and make sure that every action, every rule, every policy is more durable, as legally sound as possible. So we're taking a step back in some cases, and we're measuring twice and cutting once. And in this case, as I said in the previous answer, we'll continue to explore all of these avenues with the Department of Justice, which, by the way, is a very significant partner in some of these legal decisions, while we also continue to exercise our statutory and administrative authority that we feel are fully within our powers to do so. So my message to the folks in Louisiana and those on the front lines is we have more than one tool in the toolbox. Some of these decisions in the near term have been disappointing, but continue to watch what the agency does because we're going to hold these polluters accountable.
Thank you for coming here, Administrator Regan. Matthew Daly with the Associated Press. You mentioned the $20 billion that was announced yesterday for the Green Bank. Even by Washington standards, $20 billion is a lot of money. And there's a lot of concern on Capitol Hill about how that money will be spent and whether there really are enough guardrails to protect the taxpayers, because you're going to private groups that may or may not be transparent in how they spend it. And just wanted to ask you how you can reassure taxpayers how that money is going to be spent and that we'll know where these projects are and how the money will be used.
Well, thank you, Matthew, for that question. And, you know, I just can't help but, you know, be frustrated with some of the disingenuous attitudes for those on Capitol Hill who, you know, want public-private partnerships, legislate public-private partnerships. We're given the assignment to implement it, and then they complain about public-private partnerships. Here's the real deal. EPA received $20 billion to invest in climate solutions. We felt, hey, the government isn't the best at doing this, so why not have a transparent grant competition nationwide looking at individuals who have been doing this for years, whose business models are designed on leveraging capital. And so we had a great competition. We have 8 great national recipients. We've developed metrics for how they can use capital to finance some of these projects that we believe will create low-carbon solutions. And we have consulted with everyone from private equity to hedge fund to commercial banking. We feel really good, not only about the strength of our competition, but the guardrails and the metrics that we put in place. By the way, you know, $20 billion is a heck of a lot of money. But we know, based on the 8 recipients that we've chosen, the metrics that we put in place, we're going to pull hundreds of billions of private capital off the sidelines. I feel really good about this program. And if you were with us yesterday at the announcement, the excitement in the room, Democrats and Republicans and independents, bankers, private equity, self-help, community development, homeowners, there's a lot of excitement about this program. It's good for the planet, but it's also good for those who are trying to get into efficient, low-cost or medium-cost homes. And by the way, 70% of these investments are for low-income individuals, 20% of these investments for our rural communities. Another small percentage is for our tribal communities. This is just a winning program, and I look forward to answering anybody's questions about this program.
Hi, David Helvarg. I'm a freelancer and an author, and EPA is also overseeing $3 billion to decarbonize ports and shipping. And I spoke with your people last June about, and they admitted it's difficult to get target smaller and mid-sized ports. There's a lot of demand from the big ports for this money. Richmond, California, where I'm based, they weren't aware that the funding was even available. How are you working towards getting that funding to the smaller, mid-sized ports that are most in need? And related, a lot of shipping is going to be diverted from the Port of Baltimore now, and how is EPA involved in finding ways to respond to this immediate disaster while continuing to decarbonize the ports?
Well, listen, I'm really excited about that $3 billion. And I think if you look at our announcement, you'll see that the announcement itself and the grant competition itself, which is open now, is designed to get at large, medium, small, some of those inland ports as well. We are essentially, and the announcement was made from a smaller port in North Carolina, Wilmington, but we've also done events in Savannah and LA at some of the largest ports in this country. We are relying on, you know, not just our ability as an agency to put these advertisements out to solicit these grants, but a lot of our environmental justice partners that are on the ground, a lot of our governors and our state partners that are on the ground. Every program, every grant program that we have put out for application has been oversubscribed to date. So I don't believe we'll have any lack of interest from all of the ports across the country. But at that point, based on the criteria, we will ensure that some of the smaller and medium ports are competitive in this process. I'm excited about the electrification of ports. It marries very well with some of the heavy-duty and larger transportation rules that we put in place. And so it's an exciting time. We're talking about billions of dollars in all of these programs. And what we're seeing is EPA must help all of these entities with technical assistance because there is so much money. So I worry less about those who fear they won't get money because there's not enough. What I want to make sure is that we have the technical assistance in place so that everyone is competitive, so we can get the money in the places that need it the most and we can get the most reductions from.
Good morning. Tegan Wendland, the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. Despite decades of effort and millions of dollars spent, the Hypoxia Task Force has made very little progress reducing runoff into the Gulf of Mexico because opt-in programs are really not working. So when is the administration going to make this issue a priority?
You know, the program that the administration has made it a priority, I think to your point, it is a tough issue. What I can do is have some of my staff spend a little bit more time with you on some of the more specific issues that were taken in that region. Obviously, it's something that we've got our eye on, but I don't have the latest and greatest and would hate to send you down the wrong road. So we'll make sure that one of the 20 or so staff that are here can talk about that specific hypoxia issue.
Hi there. I'm Erin Jordan. I'm with the Cedar Rapids Gazette in Eastern Iowa, and I'm following up on that point. How content are you with the progress that's been made on reducing nutrients going down the Mississippi River to the Gulf? And would you consider supporting a multi-state compact there?
Well, listen, I as a former state regulator, I number one, believe in the power of convening and partnerships amongst multiple states with the federal government. Listen, I think we have to make a lot more progress on the nutrients issue. I spend a lot of time with Secretary Vilsack and my team on how we can do things to better tackle nutrients in this country. And so that's an area where we can spend some time talking with you about all of the tactics we're using to tackle nutrient loading, whether it's the Chesapeake Bay or any of these other areas that we'd like to talk about. This is one of these areas where we have some regulatory authority, which I believe we are leveraging to the maximum ability that we have, but this is an area where we have to have a partnership, not only with USDA, but with the agriculture community, to really design more creative and rewarding voluntary programs as we think about how we look at agriculture, farming, and other practices in this country.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I am Kelsey Tamburino with Politico. I just wanted to ask about attempts to repeal the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act on the Hill. The Green Bank that you mentioned is an area that Republicans have focused on. How are you protecting your agenda against those attempts, and particularly as we come up to a Congressional Review Act timeline?
I'm sorry, the last?
The Congressional Review Act.
Yes. You know, my general philosophy on the Congressional Review Act is that's sort of secondary for me. The primary driver for me is the sense of urgency that we face in terms of looking at the impacts of climate change. Or if any of you, which many of you have, traveled the country and look at and visit with families that are on the front lines of an environmental injustice or a storm, that's where the sense of urgency comes from. So from day one, a lot of people have focused on CRAs. I'm focused on these families and these people that I'm talking to in real time that need our help now. So that's the driver. We're trying to do as much as we can, as quickly as we can, for the people of this country. And in terms of the IRA, you know, my job is to take a look at that law and try to execute and implement it as quickly as possible for the reasons I just stated. We're seeing the impacts of climate change. We're seeing the pollution on the front lines. And so I feel really good that we're designing these programs from the IRA in a very durable way, a very fair way, so that the right people get access to these resources who needs to benefit from them the most. I'm driven by that. That's the timeline and the sense of urgency that I have. I feel really good that the IRA is a signature piece of legislation for the President of the United States. He's very proud of it. We're all very proud of it. So we'll do whatever we need to do to protect it while we also do the work that we need to do to make sure that the right people get these resources.
Yvette Arellano with Fence Line Watch in Houston, Texas. Plastic is seen as the triple planetary crisis. Later this month, the Global Plastics Treaty will have the fourth of five negotiations in Ottawa from the 19th to the 29th in April. So far, we have seen the administration, backed by EPA, back the fuel standard, which includes burning plastic for plastic fuel, supporting chemical recycling, creating loopholes for fast-tracking permits, supporting gas hydrogen, supported again by plastic fuel, pushing toward making this a carbon credit situation similar to the COPs, and no mention of protection of human rights or conversations around toxics transparency to be in line with the United Nations One Health Protocol. The U.S. has the largest delegation present in these processes. How do you see EPA pushing for the protection of EJ communities?
Thank you for the question, and I'll, you know, that's a very broad question. Let me say the overarching response is EPA, Department of Energy, Department of State, we have a whole of government approach as we look at tackling many of the issues that you laid out, and you laid out quite a few, rightfully so. I would say that, number one, I've been to about 13 countries since I've been in this job, 30-plus states. Whenever I meet with young people, plastics, aside from climate change, is the top issue that we're discussing, which is why from day one I sort of pushed my team to really focus on expediting our recycling strategy so we could have a better look at the circular economy to create all of the right parameters and the incentives to reduce waste, especially plastic, and get that out of our environment. This is an issue when you unpack it. Plastics is such an integral part of so many facets of our lives that we have to sort of unpack that. And what I can tell you is that I have responded to this issue through the EPA lens with a sense of urgency, especially spending time with our frontline communities, our EJ communities, and our international communities about what we can do, not just from a regulatory standpoint, but also from a technical advising standpoint and a voluntary standpoint to reduce the plastic footprint in society.
Good morning. My name's Lisa Sorg. I'm from NC Newsline. Hello, Administrator.
Good morning, Lisa.
As you know, sometime this spring we're going to hear from the EPA about the PFAS drinking water standards. And my question is, there should be, about a half dozen that will be in that announcement, but there are 15,000 types of PFAS. Can you explain what the regulatory or scientific challenges are to regulating those as a class?
Well, thank you for that question, Lisa. And Lisa and I go back a ways to the trauma that was inflicted on the state of North Carolina with the Gen X pollution and contamination from the company Chemours, where I and Governor Cooper had our first experience with the pervasive and invasive impacts of these forever chemicals. You know, we know that these companies continue to manufacture chemical compounds that are very hard to detect using current technology. And before this administration, there had not been an administration willing to tackle this very challenging issue. I've spent a lot of time with the Department of Defense and the Department of Agriculture walking them through how we plan to regulate these forever chemicals. And so we're going to be very bold and very aggressive, and we have a PFAS roadmap to tackle all of these pervasive chemicals. But the challenge with doing it as a class is we don't have all the science. We don't understand all of the health disbenefits for the thousands of these chemical compounds. So what we've decided to do as an administration is invest a lot more money into understanding the health impacts of all of these classes of chemical compounds. In the meanwhile, for those that we have the science and the health statistics to develop sound, strong regulations, we are doing just that. And so, as Lisa alluded to, in the coming weeks, the EPA is going to announce the first ever national drinking water standard for some of these PFAS chemical compounds. This is our attempt to make up for some of the lost time, gather the scientific and health data to ensure that we can protect our drinking water. And the first step is going to be a very strong step.
Hi there. Thanks so much for doing this. Dharna Noor of The Guardian. My question's about East Palestine, Ohio. I know that the EPA and state officials have maintained that East Palestine, Ohio residents are safe, but many there have repeatedly been asking for more air testing, have been concerned about oil sheens they've been seeing in their creeks, and have been asking for proactive measures too, like a ban on vinyl chloride. So I just wanted to ask what your response is to concerns from that community at this time.
You know, I've visited East Palestine, I believe, 4 or 5 times and spent a lot of time with the community members and completely understand that this community was unfairly impacted by the actions of Norfolk Southern. So from day one, I have pledged to hold Norfolk Southern accountable. Number two, we have really expedited the cleanup process in East Palestine. And if you take a look at how we have operated in that community in the cleanup process, we have done something in about 18 months to 2 years, what would normally take EPA 5 to 7 years to do. We have really focused on this community to try to right some of these wrongs inflicted by Norfolk Southern. We have deployed aircraft. We have mobile air labs. We have stationary air monitors. We've been there since day one. So we have a firm understanding scientifically what the reactions were from this disaster and how we have protected those communities. So we feel really good when we look at that data. We have also said that, you know, I am not here to tell anyone that they are not having a medical emergency or reaction. And if they are, please see their local medical providers, because we are working with local medical professionals to keep our finger on the pulse there. Anytime there's a trauma in a community, we want to meet people where they are. We want to hear their stories, and we want to do the best that we can to respond. I think that we've done a good job. The mayor and some of the other local officials have told us we've done a good job. We've been very transparent. But we'll continue to work with the state and local governments to continue to monitor the water, continue to monitor the air, continue to engage with the public. And as it relates to vinyl chloride, I think what I would say there is, if you look at our statutory authority under the TSCA piece of that power, we have to list these chemicals. Vinyl chloride is on that list. We are laser focused on it. We're going to try to do the proper evaluation to list that chemical compound as quickly as possible so that we can do what we need to do. I don't want to say too much because we're going to follow the process and follow the law, but we're laser focused on it.
Thank you so much. Hi, Gwendolyn Craig. I'm a policy reporter with Adirondack Explorer magazine in upstate New York. I'm currently on the whiskey fungus beat, and I was wondering if you could tell me about any upcoming changes that there could be at the Clean Air Act regarding fugitive emissions and non-fugitive emissions, especially in relation to distilleries.
That is such a niche. That is such a niche question that I would say there is somebody on my team that has the answer to that. But we are for whiskey. The right answer is we are for whiskey.
Thank you.
I'll have someone circle with you to talk about that.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I'll give you an easier one after that. I'm Ethan Brown, founder of the Sweaty Penguin podcast. Thank you. So I think as journalists, I see a lot of stories about the EPA framed as the EPA did this, the EPA didn't do that, and they often miss the civics component of it, that Congress makes the laws, the EPA and the executive branch enforce and implement the laws, and I find that a lot of my audience don't actually know that dynamic and how that works and some of the legal risks that would come from overreaching. I'm curious if you have any advice to us as to how we can better educate our audience and include that aspect in stories about your work.
Listen, I welcome this kind of partnership because we find the same problems. I'll give an example. When we really took a look at this Waters of the U.S. issue and we tried to design a regulation that would be protective of some of our wetlands and Pocosins, we knew that this issue had been unresolved for decades. But we follow the science, we follow the law, as Congress gave to us, and we were challenged. Here's the danger, and I believe where you're going with this question. When we were challenged on our Waters of the U.S. regulation, it went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court went further than those who were challenging us in their ruling, which set back that portion of water protection over 50 years. This goes back beyond Ronald Reagan and other Republicans who supported some of the things that we did. So we don't want to overreach. We want to measure twice, cut once. It's not that we're being conservative. We want to be strategic because our job is to protect people and the planet. And so I would love to have our teams talk about how we can do a better job storytelling or sharing information about what EPA's role is, the role of Congress, the role of the courts, and how we try to balance all of those things. At the end of the day, a lot of people we engage with, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners, thinks that politics drive a lot of these decisions. And it's really, you know, not. What's really driving what I'm doing as administrator is the balance between the courts, Congress, and the EPA's authority, and how we make sure that every single decision that we make is as protective of public health and the environment as possible. So we'd love to connect with you and think through how we do a better job of that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Liza Gross with Inside Climate News. First, thanks so much for coming to answer our questions. My question is about how EPA registers pesticides and problems with FIFRA implementation. So basically the notion that we have to look at a cost-benefit analysis and if a compound could cause disparate harm to communities, which, for instance, Paraquat does, to low-income Latino communities, especially in California, that the benefits to the farmers are outweigh the risk to the community. And I know EPA is right currently considering reviewing the registration for Paraquat. And, you know, researchers knew since the early 80s that it produces Parkinson's-like symptoms. And I basically want to know how EPA justifies continuing to register this compound that is so good at producing Parkinson's-like symptoms that researchers use it to study Parkinson's in the lab. And I wonder when you do make the decision to register or not, if I can see all the evidence that's being used.
Well, first of all, I want to say, you know, transparency is paramount here, so I will be sure to connect you with our staff, if you're not already connected, in terms of what we're doing on the registration front. I didn't catch that particular chemical.
Paraquat.
Pesticide, okay. And here's what I'll zoom out just a little bit and say, and I think you probably know that there's just been, number one, our chemicals and our pesticides and herbicides and that side of the house has been so underfunded by Congress for so long. As a matter of fact, you know, during the prior administration, they went in and pretty much gutted the place. Number two, I think for a lot of these chemical compounds, a lot of them have been litigated or are under litigation. And so we're trying to thread a needle. The first needle is using what we know as the best sound science to evaluate all of these pesticides and herbicides. Number two, look at the process to be sure that what you're describing isn't happening, which is we're not putting people first and we're putting money and cost and other things first. That's not what this agency is doing. So the reason I'm being very careful in this response is because I would like for you to sit down with staff, because some aspects of what we're doing has been under litigation, is currently under litigation. And so my tact has been to work with our scientific community, but also work with the agriculture community and think about, instead of fighting all of these things in court, how can we look at registering new products that we know are safer, that we can get to the market faster? I'll tell you that in my conversations with the ag industry, Farm Bureau, and others, we have a list of products we'd like to register very quickly to replace some of these that we don't like so well, but we don't have the funding to move as fast as we would like to protect these communities. So I'd love to be sure that we spend a little bit more time with you talking through the strategy of how we're applying the science while we navigate some of the difficulties of these cases that have precedents that, quite frankly, have not been beneficial to the public.
Thank you very much.
Hi there. My name is Brittany Cordera, and I'm a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma. In Lawton, Oklahoma, we have a very concerned community regarding a cobalt nickel refinery. It is my understanding that refining these critical minerals is a very new industry in the U.S., and it's coming fast without environmental impact surveys and other kinds of risk assessments. I also understand that regulations for processing critical minerals are not as strict as they are in the U.S. as they are in Canada, where these materials have been refined for much longer. One thing the community is concerned about is how they are going to be protected in a worst-case scenario. I know that there are regulations for mining these minerals, even though it's not really happening in the U.S., but I'm wondering where the EPA is at in having regulations on refining as we make the transition to electrifying basically everything in the U.S.
Well, thank you for that question, and I would, you know, just kind of push back a little bit on the premise of the question in terms of we are not regulating refineries and mining. I would love for our team to kind of sit down and walk you through what we are doing at EPA, but also what we're doing in partnership with the White House CEQ, what we're doing in partnership with DOE. You know, this is something that the president is focused on, which is as we transition to this 21st century economy, we do not want to leave anybody behind, and we don't want to transition at the expense of any community. So when we think about EISs and ESAs and permitting, there's a multi-agency approach to ensuring that there aren't disbenefits to these communities, especially our indigenous communities who have suffered disproportionately from mining activities in the past in the United States. So appreciate that question, and we'll spend some more time with you on that.
And just to wrap us up here, we have time for one more question.
Yes.
So I think we, on this side.
Hi, yes, I'm LV Anderson with GRIST. Thanks so much for being here. I wanted to take a step back and ask a question about the Biden administration more broadly, since you're here as a representative of the Biden administration. Your boss, Joe Biden, appears to be violating the Foreign Assistance Act, which bars the U.S. from giving military support to any nation that hinders the delivery of humanitarian aid. Obviously, I'm referring to Israel and Gaza. You know, this decision obviously has horrifying human rights costs, but, you know, it also imperils Biden politically, makes it less likely that he's going to be able to continue to implement his climate and environmental goals in a second term. So I just wanted to know, you know, what steps, if any, you've taken to get, you know, the Biden administration to stop violating the Foreign Assistance Act.
I'll say that I'll push back on the premise of the question that we are violating any act, but I'll also, you know, want to keep this conversation in the space that I'm the expert in, which is the president has demonstrated that he is willing to do whatever he has the authority and power to do to tackle the climate crisis, which I heard buried in that question. I don't want to respond to Gaza politics. I'm not the Secretary of Defense or National Security Advisor. So I'll leave that to the experts. What I'll say is this president and this administration and all of his cabinet officials have been leveraging every dollar, every statutory authority, every congressionally mandated power to rein in the pollution that's exacerbating the climate crisis and for those more traditional pollutants that are disproportionately impacting our environmental justice communities.
Can I do one teeny little closing question?
And I'm so sorry, that one's mine. But I do very much want to be respectful of the administrator's time. We're already running a little bit over, so we really appreciate you staying a little bit longer. And thank you, everyone, for your excellent questions. You mentioned before the communities you serve when we were talking with Politico about preserving these rules in light of CRA. And when you're talking about balancing with the courts, we all know we've got what is going to be a blockbuster ruling in Loper Bright coming up, which could really slash Chevron doctrine. We've got West Virginia v. EPA bringing major questions to the fore, and you know, its judicial review is going to get a lot thornier. And you've got a lot of really bedrock environmental laws that you've got to protect and safeguard in perpetuity. And ultimately, you know, that protect the communities that these rules are meant to serve. How are you ensuring that these rules that you've crafted over the course of the administration survive in the face of a potentially post-Chevron major questions world?
Yes, an interesting question. And listen, we are living in challenging times in so many ways. But what we at EPA are doing, we're staying focused on the mission. And one of the important reasons for shoring up scientific integrity is to lead with science, lead with the data, make sure that as we're designing and writing these rules, that we're staying technology neutral, we're setting environmental goals based on the data and the science, and we are really articulating very well in our preamble language and our rule language what authorities we have that we can use based on the science and the cost-benefit analysis that we've gone through. So to answer your question, the only thing we can do is control what we can control. And that means if we have to move just a tiny bit slower so that we write the rule a little bit more strategically or stronger based on experiences that we've had over the past couple of years. And if we've seen some holes, or maybe not holes, but the courts wanted to see more of this, that, and the other, we're trying to make sure that we put all of these things in these rules that we put forward. The best thing we can do is put our best foot forward, put forward durable rules, full of science, full of data, more language around the reason I believe we have the statutory authority to do it. And then we have to really just defend that case in court. That's about the best we can do. And I think the one thing I'll say is our staff is very attentive to how the court is responding. And so we are trying to now design more robust rules in response to the environment that we're in. And I believe that we'll win the day. Follow the science, follow the law, present an effective case. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
Great. Thank you so much, Administrator.
Thank you. Thank you all.